Welcome to Better Words, a podcast for readers who want to know the stories behind the pages.
We're your hosts, Caitlin and Michelle, two book nerds who bring you in-depth conversations about writing and publishing from those on the inside.
Basically, we're just here to talk about books.
We're so glad you're joining us.
Hello, welcome back to Better Words. We are on a bit of an excitement high at the moment because we just finished interviewing a writer who we so admire, and we had such a great chat, and we're just like, I don't know about you, Caitlin, but I'm all like, ooh, like giggly and weird.
I think we can just say, I already posted on our Instagram that our weekend reading, we both read Prima Facie and I read The Work. So we've just interviewed Bree Lee, but everyone's just going to have to wait because we've also got a lot of other things pre-recorded. So our reread episode with Bree Lee will be in your feed soon, but we've got other things to get to first. For
now. It was so good. And, you know, before we get to that episode, if you do see a copy of The Work in Australian bookstores, pick it up. Caitlin loved it, I assume. Yeah. Sorry, I just like put that on you. Like, you loved it, didn't you, Caitlin?
Of course I loved it. Oh my God, no, it's... Okay, yeah, we're completely derailed now. But yes, it's fantastic. Oh my God, I don't know. I don't quite know what adjectives to use yet, you know? But yeah, it's brilliant. These characters are so interesting and compelling and just like all these little dynamics and everything in their world and the people they interact with, you're just like, yeah, it's so engaging.
I think if you're in Australia, you're about to see a lot of it in bookshops and in your feet, which rightly so. So yeah, pick it up.
Absolutely. But now, technically, what we're supposed to be doing here today is it's book club time, and we're talking about Prima Facie by Susie Miller.
I'm also so excited to talk about this. Like, I finished it last night and I just had this feeling of like, I can't wait to just like, honestly, just one of the best books I've read ever, I think, definitely in my top for the year. And not necessarily because I was like, oh my God, I love it, because it's like enraging, but it's just brilliant. Like, I just,
yeah,
I couldn't stop thinking about it.
Yeah, I completely agree. Yeah. Okay, before one of us should read the blurb, shouldn't we? I've got it in front of me. Do you want me to read the blurb?
Yeah.
Okay. So, Prima Facie by Susie Miller. Tessa is a thoroughbred, a young, brilliant barrister from a working-class background, now at the top of her game, defending, cross-examining, and lighting up the shadows of doubt in any case. The law is a game, and she is its most talented player. One sickening night, though, Tessa finds herself in a position countless women, one in three, have been in before her. And she's faced with a gut-wrenching, life-changing decision. Will she take the stand to testify about her rape, with the full awareness that the system has not been built to protect her? So, and then it says, drawn from the internationally acclaimed play, Prima Facie is a propulsive, raw look at the price victims pay for speaking out and the system that sets them up to fail. With breakneck prose and a devastating emotional intensity, this is a novel for our times by one of Australia's most impressive writers.
I mean, I just don't even, like, you could just end this conversation there because that sums it up.
It's incredible. So and also, I don't know what you have, Michelle. I obviously have the Australian edition. So something that I think people know this about, like, you see a book and you see the endorsements on and it's supposed to, like, it tells you a bit of something about, like, it'll be the author in the same genre or, like, how they are little clues about the books. The endorsements on this book on the front are Jane Harper, Anna Funda, and Magna Szubanski, which I just butchered. And then on the back is Heather Rose and Sarah Krasnstein.
Who wrote The Trauma Cleaner.
Yes. And I feel like I said a last name wrong, but you know who I mean. And those five names are actually all so different. And it's like, Avengers of endorsements. It's incredible.
The Avengers of endorsements. I love it. So obviously I've got an international edition. And along with Jane Harper and Anna Funda, keeping in mind those books are published in the UK, so that's why they will be on there. And
I think the other three are more Australian. You have
are Australian. This also has Chris Whitaker, who I actually don't know who that is, and Karen Slaughter, who is a crime writer.
Yeah, crime thriller.
And then in the inside cover, obviously, so again, with like it's drawn from the play that Susie Miller wrote, starring Jodie Comer. So the play won 22 awards, including Best Play at the Olivier Awards, Best Performance by an Actress for Jodie Comer at the Tony Awards, and the highest grossing event cinema release ever. And all the quotes on the inside are like New York Times about Broadway debut, the Daily Mail, the Times, Independent, and, you know, Guardian, all that sort of stuff. It is, I mean, I guess I had heard about this as the play when I was living in Australia, and I'm a bit slow on the uptake. And when I actually, one of our friends got given a book and she's like, it's called Primer Facie. And I was like, huh, that sounds like that play. That's funny. And then I didn't think any more about it. And then I saw this proof in our staff room at the bookshop. And I was like, oh, my God, it is the play.
Yeah. I know. So I've been pretty dense about this book as well. I didn't pay that much attention about it until you were like, we should read that. And I was like, you know what? I probably should. And I'm so freaking glad.
Well, I remember... and I cannot link to the episode because I don't know which episode it was. It was like back in 2021 or something. An episode of Chat 10 Looks 3 where Lee Sales was talking about the play and how amazing Jodie Comer was. And I was like, wow, that sounds incredible. Sounds really good. And then just like forgot about it. I wanted to read out the letter that I don't know if it's in the finished version of the UK edition or not, or just in the advance copy, but I wanted to read, there's a letter in here from Susie Miller, and I wanted to read a few bits of that, obviously talking about the fact that it was produced in the West End in 2022, so that must have been when I heard that podcast episode. So she's written the novel Primer Facie to continue the conversation the story raises. It's been a labour of love, with the novel digging more deeply into the story, the world and the characters. Aside from awards, this story has affected people and affected change in ways one only dreams their writing could have influence, including changing the law in the UK regarding what juries are directed to consider when they deliberate on rape cases. There are words directly from the play that have been incorporated into these new directions. Judges in Northern Ireland must now view a film of the play in their training to be judges. A group of barristers have set up the TESSA project, the examination of serious sexual assault, but obviously TESSA is the name of the protagonist in this book, to change laws around the lived experiences of women and rape victims. And 3,000 police officers in North Yorkshire had a screening of the filmed play followed by discussion. Importantly, thousands of women have written to me, Jodie, and other key personnel connected to the production. It was an incredible sign for me that stories really do make a difference. In times where the arts are so under siege, it reminded me that storytellers, be they writers, actors, directors, producers, and designers, are valuable and agents who can change the cultural landscape. I'm hoping this novel creates yet more change and that it contributes a dialogue between all people, regardless of their gender, and that the conversation specifically contributes to change in the experiences of all women, our daughters and their daughters. I read, like, picked that up and read that in the staff room and I was like, fuck, that's amazing. Obviously, I'm going to read it. And then, yeah, when we were discussing things we could both read, I was like, I reckon you would love this as well.
I had seen this book around last year. It was published in Australia towards the end of last year. I don't know. Sometimes you see books around and you just don't absorb anything about them. And I
also think you're not much of a crime person, so it wouldn't surprise me that you wouldn't necessarily. Yeah, and so maybe the crime aspect...
Yeah, the crime aspect probably didn't appeal to me. I would say it looks like a crime novel.
I think the cover, it's not that it's a bad cover at all, but I think the cover makes it look more crime-centric than it's much more of a contemporary fiction novel.
Yeah, I think so.
So I just can understand why you weren't, like, seeing it in bookstores and being like, ooh, that looks like something I'll pick up.
But I think the UK edition of the book... it looks like it might have a similar cover to the, like, the West End play and things, which obviously they can't do in Australia because that was not shown here. The play was shown here years ago, obviously. Susie is an Australian playwright, but since it has been on Broadway and in the West End with Jodie Comer, that was the actress's name, right? Yeah. But yeah. But funnily enough,
from Killing Eve. She's from Killing Eve.
Yes, I know. So. I just couldn't remember her name. but funnily enough, I have just in March seen RBG of Many One, I think is the full title of the play, also written by Susie Miller, which is being rerun by the Sydney Theatre Company at the moment. Yeah, so that was amazing. Excellent.
One of the things I did as I was reading this is I was like frantically Googling, like, are they still doing, like, can you buy it on streaming? Because sometimes you can. Like, they have National Live Theatre at Home. It's not available anywhere at the moment. And I really want to see the play now that I've read the book. And I do think it's unusual.
Yes, I would want to too, because I think the book, I researched the play while I was reading the book because I was curious about how this would be on stage in a condensed kind of version. It's been fleshed out for the novel. But the main thing I was like, I need to Google it, because is it a one-woman show? Because I think it still reads that way. Like, you can kind of see the way it's been expanded out. I'm glad it still kind of has that feeling of, like, the narration, she's telling us the story of the whole thing, because that would be quite a different style, obviously. But when you think about maybe adapting a one-woman show or a play to a book, you could take it out or, like, write it in a different way. And that will be interesting too, because it is being turned into a movie, and you can't quite do that in a movie. It will be less from her perspective, just by the nature of, you obviously see the world around her in a movie, on stage. When you have one person on stage, it can be done in a different way. So yeah, it's fascinating to see stories in different mediums as well. I would love to see the play. Surely they'll show it again later. I feel like every 3 months I see ads for, like, you can see Fleabag at the cinema again or something. I'm like, surely it'll be around.
And we should say as well, like, before we get into any more, I mean, I think the Australian blurb is much more explicit in saying that Tessa is raped. The UK blurb just says, when a date with a charismatic colleague from her chamber goes awry, Tessa discovers the rule she's always played for might not protect her. So I do think it's important to say that there is a really intense description of the rape in here. You are from Tessa's perspective. And so I think, like, if that is something that could be quite affecting to you, just be conscious of that. And maybe this isn't the book for you in that case. Like, just know that there is it's a brilliant book, but that there is, like, set over several pages.
There would be a lot of tough scenes. To read, because
it could be very triggering.
Because it's also not even just that. Then when she goes to the police, and then when she's in court, there's, going over it as well, is a big part. Like, this is what the story of this book is like her having that experience and then pursuing it with the legal system. But it is so brilliantly written. I tried to explain it briefly to a friend today, saying it's like brilliant and tense and gripping and compelling, and I was kind of cringing the whole way through, and they said, in a bad way. And I was like, no, in like a, these are terrible things that are being said and that are happening, and I would like gasp and like wince, and maybe wince is a better word than cringe.
I felt like anxious reading it. Like I was tense reading it.
Like prickly, like your skin's crawling a little bit.
Yeah, it's very, like, the way that this writing elicits such emotion, I think, is brilliant and powerful, and one of the reasons why, you know, this should be compulsory reading for everyone in the legal profession. I actually had to write down some notes, because I was like, oh my God, I'm going to forget, like, all the brilliant things I want to say. So I think something to note is, like, it's set in London, and obviously the world of law is something that is built up, but we really see that through Tessa's eyes. Tessa is from Liverpool and from this working class background, and I guess we see the prejudices and the like construction of the legal industry, and the, what's the word, like the prestige of it from this outsider's perspective. Mm-hmm. And she has worked really, really hard to get in there and is always aware that she is an outsider there. Like all her friends and stuff, like, you know, they have family members who were in law. It was expected that they would go into law. Meanwhile, her brother, you know, has been in trouble with the law, I guess is the best, like that's the best way to put it. Like it's such a different thing. So she is always aware of that. And I guess that plays in a lot in her mind when she is deciding to go through with this or not. And I really love the way that that suspense is built through the timeline. So we have sort of two big periods of the book leading up to the event and then afterwards. And leading up to the event, which doesn't happen until about halfway through, it's like a bit of a slow build up, but I found it quite compelling because we are learning about Tessa's background. We are really understanding the privilege and the prestige of law and why, I guess it's just building up that like this is the machine of the law. And then afterwards we jump forward like more than 700 days that she has been waiting for it to go to trial. But then there's like now and then chapters within that where we learn what happened in the immediate aftermath, and then we jump back into the trial. So I guess there is this brilliant suspense build up as the reader once you get to the trial, because that's not playing out straightforward fashion either. And just the, like, that is so masterful in terms of storytelling that I was like on the edge of my seat the whole time.
100%. We're just coming off the Easter long weekend, right? So I read, I think, 120, 130 pages, maybe, on, like, one day when I was like, this is lovely. I'm just having a doing nothing, getting lots of reading done weekend. Then the next day I finished the book. This book is, like, 340 pages long. And I read, good two-thirds, maybe just under two-thirds. I think the blurb I read out said propulsive, and it is propulsive.
I think something else which you sort of alluded to as well is the way that it still feels like you can totally imagine it being a one-woman show. Because I think something that I noticed right at the very start, and it continues into when Tessa is on the witness stand as well, is that we have these courtroom scenes, but we don't go into specifics. So when Tessa is cross-examining someone, you just sort of get her dialogue of like, you know, I
ask him the right question.
Yeah. And
I ask him the right question. I see the jury like wince or whatever. And it's like, she's describing what's happening. It's not actually a case. Yes.
It doesn't. Yeah. And it's the same when she is being cross-examined. We're just hearing like, yes, no, I don't know. I think it would slow it down a lot more if we heard all those details. And actually we don't need those details to build a comprehensive picture, but I think maybe you would naturally, I think you would start by putting those details in and think, oh, that's fine, like, you know, you need to know that. But actually it's not until you see them without that you're like, actually you don't need to know that to build the picture that you're wanting to build, which isn't about the crimes she's necessarily I guess that she is defending or what the defense solicitor is saying to her later on. It's about the reaction and about, like, so at the start we're seeing her reaction to, I guess, winning the case versus then her reaction to being the one in the witness box.
Yeah, and that's kind of in the writing style and the style of this as well, is because the dialogue throughout the novel, even just when she's like having a conversation with someone in the hallway, it's kind of written that way where it's like, yes, no.
Mm.
This, that, like, there's no quote, you know, there's no quotation marks, there's no he said, they said, she said.
I have to read out something that just really sort of sums everything up for me about, I guess, the brilliance of this book. So this is, I think it's when she's talking to her mum. I really had thought that I was now untouchable, that if I just did my job, didn't stand out, won my cases, I was like everyone else in chambers. But I am not. I am disposable. I am rapable. Just like when I was a kid on the estate, nothing has changed. It's the class of the man who can rape me. I feel foolish. And I think that sort of sums everything up about the way that it's not just sexism and misogyny that we're looking at in this book. We're also looking at class, and those two things are intertwined, because the very fact even that she is taking on someone whose father is a KC and whose friends are all barristers is kind of the fact that she wants to keep going with it, despite, like, she sort of says, I think at one point even, like, if I find this so hard, like, how does anybody else do it? Like, it really speaks to the bravery of every woman who continues with a complaint. And that is not to say that those who don't continue with complaints or don't follow through in court are any less brave at all, but it really points out how stacked the system is against women, that the conviction rates are so low, and it's absolutely shocking. And I think it's apt that we spoke to Bree Lee today, because so much of, I kept thinking as I was reading this book, how much it reminded me of Eggshell Skull in that sense. So that is Bree Lee's first book. It's like memoir, kind of nonfiction examination. Obviously there's a lot of differences, but in that Bree Lee was working as a legal clerk. She was working in the law, and she decided to pursue a case against for historic sexual abuse, and obviously details in that, like knowing what she would face. And it's similar in that sense of having the inside knowledge of how the system is basically stacked against you. It's such a powerful book, and something that I'm so pleased to hear that those directions have been changed. And I guess the directions that have been changed, and the wording that comes from Prima Facie, is in regards to the fact that in court we expect things to be sort of picked over in a chronological order. We expect you to be able to recall events in detail. Basically, what we see happen in this book, and what happens in real cases, is that defense lawyers will often sort of pick apart things that maybe a witness is misremembering. Like, you know, they say the lamp was blue, the lamp was red. And so they indicate that must mean the rest of their memory of the event is faulty. But psychologists have actually shown that someone who's a victim of sexual assault will remember exactly who the person is and what they did, but they might not get the order right and might not know those peripheral details. So now judges in the UK are sort of changing the direction to say to people, like, just because someone doesn't remember something perfectly, it doesn't mean that they're lying in this case. And I just think that's amazing.
That's amazing.
It's amazing, amazing change. But this book, like, in terms of a reading experience as well, like, this book has extra sort of peripheral stuff that I'm amazed by, and that I think, but in terms of a reading experience, it's fucking brilliant. Like, it is, as we said, propulsive. It's like tense. It's really wonderfully written, in a way that is like, I don't know, it never feels like it's too much. Like, it feels very matter of fact, but yet emotional. And like, you really, I think the fact that it does take you so long to build up to that night really helps you understand Tessa, understand her life and where she's coming from.
Yeah.
I think that's a real kind of master move.
And that is tense too, because it's not, you know what this book is about if you read the blurb. And so you're just kind of like, oh my God, oh my God, oh my God. Like, unfortunately,
yeah, you know it's
like,
coming.
You know it's coming. And that's a really tense, suspenseful part of reading the book as well. And then afterwards, you're just like, oh, yeah, it's gut wrenching.
It's an amazing book. Like, it really is brilliant. And I just hope more and more of those situations where people, like police, judges, people in the law, have to watch it or have to read it, because it is so affecting. And the fact that we see her as a defence solicitor, or defence barrister, sorry, and then her on the stand, you know, talking to herself, being like, where she says, no, I think so. And that inner voice is telling me, don't say you think, be sure. And you're really in that. Like, it's just, it's written in such an immediate and incredibly moving way. It's, yeah. as I say, like, definitely one of the best books I've read this year. Like, I don't think anything will top that level of, like, oh, it's just, but it's certainly not a book for everyone in that,
no.
you know, it does deal with
it
really
is quite an
stuff,
intense read. But, so I think
yeah.
that's really something to be aware of. But if it sounds interesting to you at all, my God, pick it up. It's incredible. Mm.
So yeah, that was Prima Facie by Susie Miller. And now we are both desperately hoping that we will be able to find, you know, that somewhere that is offering the filmed performance of it online.
Yes, I really want to watch it. And I will be waiting for the movie now as well, because
yeah,
that is yeah. happening, apparently. We know these things can take a long time, but there's like a director, like it's happening. There's like quite a few things yeah. that give me hope that it won't be too far away, but obviously these things take time. So all right, and now on to our wonderful interview with Emma Darra.
Our guest today lives and works on Dharawal country. She holds a PhD in creative writing from the University of Wollongong, and her writing has appeared in numerous Australian publications. In addition to being a writer, our guest works as a mentor with the South Coast Writers' Centre and is a sessional academic at the School of Arts, English and Media at the University of Wollongong. We are really excited to be discussing her debut novel. Welcome to the podcast, Emma Darra.
Hello, thank you for... Oh, sorry, I should say thanks for having me. I'm going to be punning on that a lot, I hope.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's right there. Like, what are you going to do? Thanks for having me. It's so good. Thank you so much for joining us, Emma. We are excited to talk about this novel. It's very... unique, and we both really enjoyed it. So we're so glad you're here.
Oh, that makes me really happy. I'm excited to be here.
And I hope you don't mind me saying that it is weird in the best possible way. Like, I am obsessed with the structure and the idea of how you've told this story. And it's just so clever. We can't wait to kind of dive into that a little bit more today.
Oh, I love it. I love weird books as well. So that makes me really happy.
Yes. And I will out you and say you were very kind and said that you've been binge listening to our podcast before joining us today. And that is very, very sweet and very kind of you. So thank you very much. So to start us off, before we really dive in, how do you describe this novel?
I sort of describe it as a short story cycle, but it's always a novel in stories. So it's about three generations of women in one family. We see them at different points in their lives, and it's about how they overlap, their lives overlap, but also how they sort of disconnect. So we've got Marianne, and we've got her daughter Vivian, and then we've got Vivian's daughter Evie. And it's sort of all about their struggles with family, with belonging and connection, and also that sort of desire for freedom. Is how I sort of think about it.
It is a hard book to describe, and you are absolutely right.
I'm obsessed with the way that sort of the blurb official description describes it as, and I'm going to read it out, like a shoebox full of old photos. They aren't in chronological order and few are labeled. Looking at a family this way reveals things we don't see when these moments are neatly organized, except that within these pages are a few moments you wouldn't want to hold up to the light. Like, I am absolutely obsessed with that, and I was using that description of like the photos out of a shoebox to tell one of my colleagues about the book. And it's such a cool way of looking at it too, because it's just relates to like the family themes and stuff, but it does give you that immediate sense of nostalgia and the idea of sitting down with this box of family photos, which I'm sure we all had. Especially, I mean, it's kind of sad these days that we don't end up with those boxes because we all live digital lives. But Caitlin and I are old enough that, you know, I'm sure most of our childhood and stuff, there was the family photo box.
Yeah.
But yeah, I'm just so obsessed with this format, like I said in that description. Where did this come from?
So I was really inspired by Elizabeth Strout's novel in stories, Olive Kitteridge. And so I remember reading that. And when I did my honours year at uni, this was for my proposal, I found this really great review that talked about sort of the tension between the whole and the individual parts. And we kind of get this really nuanced portrait of this woman, but we see her from multiple different perspectives. So it's not all just from within her sort of point of view. So we kind of see her from different angles. And I really like this idea of this portrait that that was sort of really multi-layered and from multiple different angles. So that's where it came from. And I sort of wanted to do that about Vivian. So it all came out of this Vivian character. So that's where it all began. And then I just got obsessed. There are so many good novels in stories that, yeah, so I'm obsessed with it as well.
It's a very interesting structure.
I've never come across this format before. So can you, I mean, before we dive into yours a bit more, are there any others that we should read? Obviously, Olive Kitteridge, which I've heard about, have always thought I should read that. It's a bit of a modern classic, but I haven't read it yet.
Oh, so Jennifer Egan has A Visit from the Goon Squad, which is a bit weird and uses, like, there's a PowerPoint presentation as one of the stories. So that's a really big one. But there's also, like, some really classic ones from, like, James Joyce has Dubliners, which is a story cycle.
Oh, I didn't realize
Alice
that.
Munro. Yeah, she has a couple of books of people just think they're short stories, but they're actually the novel in stories. So those are a few sort of big names. But yeah, and also I want to shout out Elizabeth Tan, who is an Australian writer. She has a really good one called Ruby. And then Joshua Lobb has The Flight of Birds. They're two Aussie ones that I studied for my PhD. Yeah. And they talk about all different kinds of stories. Yeah.
Excellent. Always love a good list of recommendations. That sounds so good, because I agree with Michelle. I don't think I've read a book with this structure before. Not exactly this, like, short story cycle, all disjointed. You know, it's kind of timely, actually. I haven't watched it yet, but the One Day new adaptation on Netflix, like, it's things like that where it's like maybe the same day every year, or like even one of my favorite, like, A Moody Christmas, like going back on Christmas every year, you know, like things like that. There's slightly similar, you know, like the vibe of like the disjointed narrative is a bit similar, but
they're
it's
all
not,
moving forward in the same chronological order, though.
Actually, yeah, and this isn't chronological, so that's a bit different too. Mm. I can't think. I think I've read a book once that was backwards, like the chapters were like you read and you kind of like you knew what happened, and then you got to the incident at the end, and I forget what the name of that even was. But yeah, it's yeah, fascinating.
Yeah, I love those ones that just do different things. Like, it's not just a straight line. And like, even things like, I loved One Day and I haven't seen it. I read it years ago and I loved that too. I like the idea of that you can be a little bit different and interesting with the structure, but like, you still want to have that emotional connection and get people to feel things and there to be a sense of a story. And so, yeah, I like things that are a little bit weird.
If anyone's like listening and curious, obviously they need to read this book. It's wonderful. But, you know, I have to admit, when I started it, I was like, am I going to feel the same way about characters that you do in a novel? Because obviously it's told you switch perspectives and you switch, oh my gosh, what's the word for when it's like first person and... or second person, or third person, whatever that is. I'm just having a mental blank.
Whatever. Tense?
Tense.
No, yeah. Is it tense?
Yeah, the tense and there's perspective of the narrative, they all change.
Yeah. So I was like, but it's kind of like whenever I've read a novel in verse as well, at the start, every single time, I'm always super skeptical about like, will I really care about these characters as much as I would with, you know, a quote unquote traditionally formatted novel? And each time I'm absolutely blown away that I am and that I get it. And actually I was like halfway through this and there's a pivotal point where someone leaves in a relationship and I was like, oh, that's this person, not this. And I had put together something that had happened. It was, I'd sort of realized, I thought back to that, the story, which is probably one of my favorites, most vivid in my mind, because it reminds me of my sort of childhood Christmases. But the Christmas Day stuff, again, very moody Christmas vibes of the family at Christmas. And I'd sort of been like, oh, right. Like there was just moments where I was like, oh, okay, I'm connecting the dots now and seeing how the story. So I think the second half of Thanks for Having Me, you get that payoff of putting together things that have happened in the first half. And it felt so like so much satisfaction to be like, oh, right. So then this, right. Okay. Yes. Now I'm getting it all.
I find it looks, I love reading crime novels. So like, I love, that's my favorite genre. Like I love literary fiction and I love crime. And I love the satisfaction of putting the puzzle together. When you see, like, have this little flash of recognition, like you see a name or there's an image or there's a phrase or something, and like, where have I seen that before? And you want to go back. And so it's different to a novel, which can be really immersive. And I love novels, but I think that there's something about the form that kind of makes you think in a different way. And that's kind of what I was going for. So hearing you talk about that little bit of confusion, but still feeling the feelings makes me really happy, because that's what I really was going for. So the reader could have a sense of sort of this intellectual satisfaction as well.
I wonder too if it's almost that you go into it as a reader, especially like someone who doesn't read many of these forms of novels, maybe it's that you go in a little bit unarmed and a little bit like unaware. So you have even more of a payoff of like I said, maybe you're a bit skeptical and then you're like, oh, like it is very satisfying as the reader to be on the receiving end of that like payoff, I guess, rather than being led along a little bit by the normal sort of style of chronologically telling a story and stuff like that.
I want to ask you about these characters because you said before that did it all kind of start with the character of Vivian, and she's in the middle of these three women. So can you tell us a bit about how that character came to you and how it kind of started all of this?
Yeah, so I kind of think like Vivian and her sister Susan have been playing Barbies in my head for so long now, like for years. And so I was in a creative writing subject and I was doing an experiment, and I was going into some Freud and doing all this like weird stuff. And then these two little girls came out, and their mum wasn't very nice to them when she discovered them making their Barbies have sex. So that was kind of the beginning. And then in another creative writing class, I was in a workshop, someone was shared a story that they'd written about a couple that got divorced. And I was like 31 and I'd just been divorced. I was like a mature age student. I was the oldest in my class, and I'd resisted writing about motherhood, and I'd resisted writing about divorce because I was trying to forge a new identity for myself, and I didn't want to be seen as just a mother. But when I heard this story from this student who was much younger, I thought, well, this isn't really what it's like. This is a bit of a cliched version of that. So I thought, well, maybe I should just write a version of that. And so I wanted to write about really complex characters, and I wanted to write about Vivian, and I wanted her to be like a sexual kind of woman as well as a mother. So that's where she kind of came out first. And then of course, to be a mother, she had to have a child. So Evie was kind of born.
Wow. Yeah. And of course then Vivian also, like her mother character was there as well as her sister from your original ideas. And Vivian and Susan are, yeah, they're such interesting characters. And I love sisters. I feel like, was it last year, Michelle, we talked about sisters all the time. Suddenly we'd picked all these novels about sisters, and I have a sister, and Michelle doesn't have any siblings, and so we just find it so fascinating.
But I feel like also this actually, year, yeah, I Michelle, feel like we've done a lot of like family, like, you know, motherhood, parenthood, like they seem to all be having a lot of themes that we talk about.
We have unintentional themes, maybe.
Yeah.
But I mean, family relationships, and especially between women, I think mother, daughter, sisters, it's endlessly fascinating. There's so much there, which is obvious because you explored a lot of it through this novel, through all of their perspectives. It is all there. I can barely even remember how, like, the men in this book, like, they're barely there, it feels like sometimes. They're not important.
Yeah, there are like the sisters and the like kind of, Marianne's sister comes in, and I kind of like have a real soft spot for her. And then it's just kind of these little doubles kept coming out. I love reading about sister and intense female friendships. I love those kinds of things. I think are really interesting. And I think a lot of them are coming out now because people realize, oh, we want to read about that.
When did this story then with these women in your mind, like if Vivian was kind of mainly first, when did it become from all of their perspectives and this kind of disjointed structure?
So I wrote like six of the stories or chapters during mm-hmm. like 1 year when I was doing my honours. And then one of my examiners said that the mother was kind of an absence in, like there's nothing about the mother. For a collection that was about mothers and daughters, I'd kind of erased her mother. That was really interesting to me. So then I spent a lot of time trying to figure out, okay, who's Marianne? Why is she the way she is? It was a gradual process and I just sort of let myself kind of, I did a lot of writing experiments and just sort of playing and using different prompts and seeing what would happen. And then she just kind of came, and she is a little bit more distant, I think, than Evie and Vivian. But I think that kind of, well, I hope that kind of is kind of her generation as well.
Yeah, I think so. And I think even with this story being about all three of them, Vivian is still kind of the central character. And as you sort of alluded to before with like how, you know, women in the family disconnect from each other, that is maybe why Marianne isn't as big a character. But I don't even know if it would be like, I don't know what the like percentage or whatever would be. Maybe you know, like how many stories are from Marianne's perspective, Vivian's perspective, and Evie's perspective, because there's still a lot of her in there. But I think it's quite clear as a reader that Vivian is the main person that we are following, and like people's relationship to her.
I think she's kind of at the center because you know she's the one that's been left and she's the one that leaves, so she's kind of the center of this little galaxy.
Do you know, you know, the math of it, how many stories are Marianne, Vivian, and Evie?
Look, I did have roughly a whole stack of, I had a stack of index cards and I tried to because there are 36 stories or 36 chapters, and okay, I tried to be somewhat even, so I'm not 100% sure, but if there are, even I know that Vivian has some longer stories. Okay. So we kind of are in the thick of her perspective. So, and like, and I figured like Evie's like younger, her stories are always shorter, like this little short burst of childhood epiphany or little flash of memory. Like I think about the way that we remember things, which kind of also plays into why the book is structured the way it is that memory, we don't remember things in a straight line or as a neat story. I think we have like little flashes, like a smell or a song will take us back, or we'll remember something really vividly from when we were 13, but don't remember something from when we were like 23. I'm kind of answering another question right now, but yeah, that kind of plays into why sort of Vivian, I think, kind of feels like she's driving this narrative. She kind of is that, she is the link in the chain.
Yeah, definitely. So you said something about note cards, so I want to jump back to structure.
Yep.
How do you decide what order these stories go in if they're purposefully out of order?
I know this is a good question, because I sort of thought it's like I've got three characters and they each need to have their own arc, and each story within the arc needed to stand alone as an independent story. That was kind of my challenge to myself. So I had like a little stack of index cards, and each, like, so Vivian's name was in pink, Marianne's was in red, Evie's was in blue. And I would have like the title of the story, maybe a couple of key images and what we kind of learn, how it sort of connects to the big picture. And then I kind of wanted it to feel more like an emotional arc, because obviously you've read the book, so you know that there is a story in the middle that kind of feels like it could be the ending, but the actual ending of the book happens much before that. So yeah, it was kind of all about an emotional arc of having a sense of, I guess, return to the beginning and to rethink how things happen.
Because it's like what you were saying about memory as well, is like that's more realistic, isn't it, as you kind of keep thinking about things and people in your life, and you know, kind of come back around, and that's the overall emotional journey, but not what kind of happens in order.
And I'm really curious too as well though, so obviously like you had written these in separate stories and stuff, but then when you decided to explore the novel, this is such a like nerdy question, but then did you sit down and sort of do the note cut and kind of work out the order of like, this is where the stories are going to be, or did you write them totally out of order and then be like, okay, this is where they're going to go?
Kind of a bit of both. I wasn't okay. Finished yet. And I had them all written out, but I knew that it wasn't done. And I knew that there was a story, I needed a story about a particular moment in their life, of Vivian, for instance. It was kind of a bit of both. So I had those six that I started with. And then I'm an erratic, chaotic kind of writer. Like I have lots of little things, bits and pieces, and then I just play with them and suddenly they kind of take shape and become what they need to become. So it was kind of a little bit of both, to be honest. So that was a great question, Michelle. I don't know if I answered.
No, it's so curious. Like I said, like those two questions were the main sort of things I was thinking as I was reading it, was like, do you sit down and do it in a non-chronological structure, or did you just write all these stories and then go, right, how do we piece them all together and stuff? So I think those were the most like the main things that.
Or like a playlist when you hit shuffle and you're like, this is how they come out.
Well, I made a timeline. I had to make a timeline because of all the dates. And so I had a timeline that I'd on a big piece of paper so that I would plot out the chronology. It still took a really great proofreader/copy editor to check me on my dates because that was a mass is not my strong point. But
and we have lots of different ages, it's not chronological, and we have lots of things where you're referring back to different things in different stories and stuff like that. So I can understand that would, if I thought about that too much, it would definitely make me confused. So, you know.
So then the pieces that were originally the first pieces you had, or maybe whichever pieces were published by themselves before this was a novel, like what was the step then to keep going and turn it into a novel?
When I started submitting them out to be published, I'd already had the vision for the whole novel being together. But like they got published at, you know, so like a little Evie story got published in a nice little indie publication. But I still didn't know how things were going to wind up for everyone. I still hadn't written the final story. And then it's kind of also the challenge is like, I'm like, it's out there. That's how it is. I get very set kind of attached to that version of things.
Yeah. Did you change anything for the final book?
I didn't change anything. Like I didn't really change anything. Like there was some like little minor copy edit changes, but I kind of accepted that as part of kind of the challenge in a way. Like I love to have constraint. Like I feel like if I can write about anything, I can't write.
Yes.
The book is like, it's not a normal kind of straightforward book, but like I wrote that using a lot of rules for myself.
I kind of like that. If the stories had already been published, it's like canon. So you're like, I can't change that. Yes. That's already happened.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. I'm so interested in like just the behind the scenes nature of this. What were some of your rules?
Okay. The last story had to prompt a return to the beginning. So there had to be something of whether that's abstract or more explicit, that was one of my little rules. I think the other rule was I did want to have a balance, at least numerically, of how many stories each character got. So I had to try and show, kind of give equal airtime in a way. But the other thing was when I was writing Marianne, because she was a bit more abstract to me, like in the Vivian stories, Marianne's a bitch. Like she's not nice. Mm-hmm. Vivian, that's how Vivian sees her. She calls her that. And then I'm like, I have to write stories from her perspective and connect with her. And for me, that was a bit of a struggle because I was so kind of attached to Vivian's version of things. But I teach at creative writing at uni and I was talking about post-structuralism and Derrida and all about contradiction. So I was like, you know what? I can like allow for this contradiction. Like it, Marianne can see things in a totally different way to Vivian and that's okay. So that's kind of not a rule. It's kind of a rule that I broke, I guess, in terms of, you know, wanting to be consistent and to have this family portrait, but then realizing that, you know, no one is going to see even a photo of a family they're not going to see the same photo. People are going to look at different things and remember different things about that day. So,
oh my God, yeah, that's so human. Yeah. That's so like, and there's that thing as well, isn't there, of like people saying like even siblings, you know, every sibling gets like sort of parented differently and their like recollections of things are going to be different. And, you know, you as the parent are going to give them different experiences. And it's just wild, isn't it, when we're so so self-centered to be like our version of events is the version of events, because that is kind of what it means to be human, isn't it? So we're there being the main character and it's wild and weird to suddenly turn around and be like, oh yeah, maybe my mum was a bitch to me, but here's why. Or maybe like maybe it was not justified, maybe it was. Like, understanding Marianne's perspective helps us so much. Yeah. But it's literally like, that's just, it's human nature, isn't it? And it is relationships, and it's so, it feels so real. So yeah, I can understand as well, like you as the writer get attached to certain, it's like your friends, when your friend's like, my ex-boyfriend shit or whatever. And then you hear the other side and you're like, oh, maybe, like, but you're like, no, but my loyalty is to my friend.
Yeah. Exactly.
And like, of course, Vivian sees her mother as a bitch when she's a teenager, and then you swap to Marianne's perspective and she's like got this awful teenage daughter, you know, like that's, everyone has that. Like, we all look back, I think, and think how awful we were as teenagers, especially girls. Teenage girls are terrible.
Exactly. Yes.
The perspectives are endlessly fascinating. It really is.
I know. And I feel like we're dancing around it a little bit here because we don't want to talk about everything too much because, as we've said, it's obviously from many perspectives and out of chronological order, and it's a bit hard to discuss in that way, knowing that many of our readers will not have read the book, but they should. Continuing on, our favourite question. The journey to publication, we have to ask you about that now. So can you, we've discussed obviously the stories being published and you wanted it to be a full novel, but can you tell us a bit about the journey when you were starting to write them and like, you know, getting an agent or getting a book deal and how that happened for you?
Yeah, sure. So like I said, I was doing it through for my PhD. I was writing this book and finally starting to get brave and to send stories out for contests and publications, getting lots of rejections. But one of my favorite stories in there, I sent out so many times, and it's the girls, 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 that story. And I knew that like it's a little bit audacious because it's a bit of a saucy story. So, you know, like I had sort of big hopes, and then a friend of mine read it. She's like, yeah, that story is not going to get published. It needs other stories around it to kind of cushion it. And I'm like, okay, great. But so I had a friend who I knew, who I trusted. I've got like a few friends, really good readers and writers, but one friend who had taught me a little bit at uni, and then she became my friend after the fact. She connected me with her agent, and because she said, I think she'll love your work. And so, yeah, it kind of happened that way. And when I met my agent, she had it over like before Christmas in 2022. Yeah, so she had it over Christmas of 2022, and I was like I was so nervous. And then she called me up to have a meeting with her, and she started talking to me about her family, and I was like, oh wow, she really gets this book. And yeah, so I was like, I think we're together now. And so she kind of is awesome and made it all happen. So that's kind of I guess the story is kind of being in the right place at the right time, doing the right things, like working on my writing and being part of a little community. And when you do that, people will read your work and then they sort of realize, oh, I think you got something.
Yeah, absolutely. And so then after you had your agent, if you said you maybe were like signed to your agent in early 2023, the book is obviously publishing in early 2024. Was it quite quick then to get a book deal with a publisher?
Yeah, it felt like a long time because you're waiting
waiting to hear. Very stressful.
Yeah. I know. So it was like March 2023 when my agent's like, oh, this is what we've got. Basically, I didn't have to do a structural edit. I don't know that anyone would know how to do a structural edit of this book because it's very
Yeah.
Yeah. So,
oh my God, I hadn't even thought of that. That's so funny. Of course it doesn't, like, yeah. I don't know. I guess maybe if you would have a suggestion to, like, move a story somewhere else for, you know, for the impact. But yeah, how do you, it's this, the structure is so specific. How do you do a structural edit?
Was it more on a story level of, like, let's go through each story?
When I sent it to my agent and she read it for the first time before we sent it out, I was like, okay, there's one little crappy little placeholder. It was like a poem more than a story. And I'm like, I want to do something with that. And so she gave me a couple of weeks and I wrote a new story. But otherwise, yeah, then it was just sort of copy editing, some light copy editing and the proofreading and getting those dates. Dates, yeah. Right.
Getting everything lined up.
Yeah. So it was pretty, you know, like it's kind of goes quiet for a while and then there's a flurry of activity.
And then I would love to ask you about the cover as well, because the cover is so striking and really cool. So how did you, were you involved at all in that process, or how did you feel when you saw it for the first time?
They asked me, Emma, can you send through some photos of some book covers that you love and some that you hate? Of recent books. And so I went through and like they're like telling things and I'm like, oh, obviously I love pink and I like kind of retro. They took that and they gave it to Alyssa Danilo, who was the designer. I saw this was the one that they took some time to get it to me to approve. Mm-hmm. I saw it and I was like, oh my gosh, I hope that's too cool. I don't know if I can, it's such a cool cover. Like it's so beautiful. And my publisher was talking about kind of the rationale behind it and I'm like, you get this book, that the crushed lollipop, like the, you know, the loss of innocence, like there's something really sweet about it, but this, it's got a bit of an edge. Yeah, so I just saw it and I was in love. So I'm obsessed with it. Yeah.
And the nostalgia, yeah, I think cover too, of like there's something nostalgic about that font, the retro font, which does, I guess, leads back to the old photos and the idea of a mix of photos. And like, I remember this certain photo album that my mum had, for example, with all the little black and white snaps and stuff like that. So it just kind of made me think of that era.
Yeah, awesome. And it's also like the way that we kind of romanticize the past as well. Yeah. And like, you know, the things that we take photos of, and that's what I tried to have in the book, was like, it wasn't about, you know, the big moments in a family's album, right, are usually like weddings, birthday parties. And there are no weddings in this book. You kind of see the, oh, are they going to get married? You see like kind of the moments are a little bit adjacent,
yeah,
or the things that you wouldn't really want to take photos of. So I think it's kind of tapping into that, like it's nostalgic, but it's also kind of, there's an irony in it, which I really love. It's not as sweet. There's something dark under the surface.
And so I'm curious, obviously this has only just come out and I hate to be like, tell me about your next thing. But what I'm curious with is it something where you think you will play with structure again, or do something in this kind of non-linear way again, or would you like to try something more traditional? Like what do you already have any ideas for what might be on the future view?
Yeah, so because I've been thinking about this form and I've been reading like all the different kinds, I've been like sort of discovering lots of books that are on like in your regular bookshop. I'm like, oh, that's a novel in stories. That's I want to play with this form again, maybe a little bit more chronological or a bit not about a family. I've started something because I'm also interested in crime, right? So I'm interested in kind of in sort of that really dark stuff. So I do want to play with that form again, but I would also like to write like a cozy mystery. So yeah. There's a few. Yeah. And I do like different for my next book, I've got a few little experiments that I want to try and see how they play out.
Awesome.
I'm so sort of excited, though, to sort of see what experiments you do. I love that, you know, I think that experimental style of writing, like, yes, it can be hit and miss, but I think it's that, I guess, that thing of if you take a big risk, you might have a really big reward in creating this really fascinating story told in a fascinating way, which you have done for Thanks for Having Me, which, yeah, sort of, I guess, brings us back around to the start of, we really loved this book and we really, really want everyone to read it because it's just fascinating. And yeah, I think it would be the perfect like book club pick because there's so much to talk about in terms of the structure of the book, but also in terms of the themes, motherhood and relationships and all that juicy stuff. And it's, yeah, we, like we said, it's been hard to sort of chat about some of those things. We don't want to spoil it for people, but they need to go and read it. But yeah, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you. It's been so much fun. Thank you.
Oh, we've just had a blast.
Where can people find and follow you online?
Oh, so you can find me on mostly Instagram. So I'm Emma L. Dara, and I have a website, which is emmadara.com. So that's probably the two places that you can find me.
Amazing. Thank you for listening to Better Words. For even more recommendations, you can subscribe to our monthly newsletter on Substack at betterwords.substack.com.
We'd also love to continue the conversation on Instagram, where you can find us at Better Words Pod.
You can also follow me, Caitlin, at Just a Bookish Babe.
And for more bookish discussions, find me, Michelle, on Substack at theunfinishedbookshelf.substack.com.
Just like with books, podcasts like ours rely on word of mouth recommendations.
So if you enjoyed this episode, please share it with a book-loving friend and leave a rating or review. We'd really appreciate it.